Greetings from BBS Radio, where truth and news still exist in the original form. You're tuned in to The Spiritual Politician, the show that shows you where politics and government went wrong and how you can take action to make it right. I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster, your host for this hour of very personal discovery. If you have a question or insight, call us toll-free from any place on the face of the earth to 1-877-876-5227, or call us direct to where'd it go? Well, but I'll give you that later in the show. Now, what we're going to do now is I'm going to talk to you about some of the things that have been going on here at BBS Radio and some of the things you're going to be hearing about tonight. As you know, this show is carried online, and you may also be able to get it on the air in your local area. If you find an old-fashioned on-the-air station in your show and you want that station to carry this show, you can always call up and ask them to do so. And you can contact us at bbsradio.com. The website for this show is up and can be found on the BBS Radio site at spiritualpolitician.blogspot.com. All past shows are available as soon as it's earthly and heavenly possible on the station archives. And you can read my own blog at http://howtheneoconsstolefreedom.blogspot.com. And now our Ada thought for the evening. As you know, we have been following the unraveling story of Ada L. Smith, state senator for New York for the area of Queens. And I wish today I could tell you something more definitive, but yet again, we have discovered that things are being put off, and we're starting to wonder whether or not yet another cover-up from those in authority is coming down the line. And a short but pointed book review. It isn't very often that I read a book that I think that everybody out there should really connect with, but this is one. It has a very unusual title, and the title is Bullshit Artist. In case you couldn't guess, the subject of the book is the president of our country, George Bush. And the book covers what happened on 9/11. So in the book, you actually get to read every word that was published that Bush spoke on that day. And you read it in a way that shows you more clearly than he would probably like what was actually going through his mind. The author of the book is Ron Shacklow, and I suggest that you go out now and buy it. For not only will it inform you, I promise you it will make you laugh. And now our thought for the week ahead. Coalition means coming together to take action, usually with people you do not normally work with or maybe even trust. Such action brings us closer together and begins to erase the chasms of distrust and misunderstanding that so often divide us. The communication this fosters creates trust, and trust builds a shared future that brings prosperity, fulfillment, and for some of us, joy. When we use the word coalition, we tend to think of smoky rooms where political deals are cut and bomb-throwing radicals lurk in sordid hotel rooms. But that's not what the word should really evoke in our minds. To collate is to join seamlessly pieces that find place relating to each other. The word should as well evoke an extension of belonging, a trust that enlarges our community in unexpected directions. Trust is sort of soul capital that we bank on when material things fail us, which they always must do from time to time. If you've ever spent your time working, not for monetary profit, but to make the world a better place, you do so with the idea you are investing, pouring your time into an enterprise that would yield dividends that could enlarge the fund of goodwill each of us must draw on from time to time. At the time, you may have appreciated the smile of someone you helped. Such moments are nice because they never wear out like some other things do. Notice that I'm using the words we usually associate with money. I'm doing that intentionally to demonstrate that there are many ways of accumulating capital and many kinds of capital that we can work to create. Some of these remain on Earth after we die, but some of those funds we can and do take with us. What are you investing your life in? What kind of interest will those investments yield? Think about it. It may be time to diversify your portfolio. Coalition, that coming together to take action, comes in many forms and for many reasons. But any coalition begins with a single point of agreement that opens us up to listening, to hearing, and cooperating on a joint venture. Our guest tonight is Sean Haugh, a longtime libertarian activist from North Carolina, who's going to share with us his story of a coalition beginning to take place there that is allowing people from diverse political parties to come together to work. Sean Haugh ran for U.S. Senate in North Carolina as a libertarian nominee a couple years ago. He served as executive director for the Libertarian Party of North Carolina and on the Libertarian National Committee. He lives in Durham, North Carolina with his wife, Pam Adams, and their family of two dogs and eight cats. One wonders how they all get along. Sean's current project is with the North Carolina Open Elections Coalition, and you can find his website at http://www.ncopenelections.org. Open and honest elections are one of the essential components Americans need to be able to set direction for ourselves. Cooperative efforts between such seemingly diverse political institutions as Green, Libertarian, Populist, and Reform may be the force that returns control finally to the people. Now, Sean, are you there?
I'm here.
Well, it's so nice to have you on our show. Thank you for being with us this evening.
Well, thank you so much. It's a real pleasure being here. And I just thought I was listening to your words about coalition there, and I just thought that was beautiful because that really describes a lot of where I'm coming from with this, just on a spiritual level. Now, I'm a Christian. You know, I'm going to speak in the language of Christianity. People can feel free to translate any way that helps them. For my words to make sense, but you know I firmly believe that God didn't put us here together on this earth to hate each other and fight with each other. You know, He put us here together so that we could learn to come together, you know, and we could learn to live together. And I was just thinking about those things when you were talking about the real positive spiritual capital that you get from working with all different kinds of people from all different kinds of backgrounds and walks of life. And you come to realize that people have so much more in common with each other, and there's so much good that we can all work for, regardless of anything else that we might believe or anything else that we're doing with our lives.
That is so true, Sean, and that exactly goes to the point of the show. That's why we call it the spiritual politician. It's bringing all parts of our lives into congruence with our spiritual nature, which, of course, is what Christ told us to do 2,000 years ago.
Exactly. I mean, if there's one thing that you take from his teachings at all, it's that we're supposed to love each other.
Amen. And you're supposed to see other people, not just to love them, but to see them as an extension of yourself and him.
Exactly. Exactly right. And we're learning a fair amount about that in North Carolina. It's really fascinating working with this Open Elections Coalition. Because you're right, we feel that we're coming together on a number of voting reform issues, particularly ballot access.
Mm-hmm.
But the coalition is becoming broader in that, because what's been going on with the voting rights and election reform movements across the country is that there are about 10 or 12 really fantastic issues that pretty much all people who are working on any of these issues agree upon. And the pattern has been for people who have been interested in any one of those issues to work on that issue separately. And there's been a sort of a sense of competition in there, or a concern that if we put effort behind somebody else's idea, that we might be diluting the strength behind our own.
Mm-hmm.
But as we're starting to come together, particularly around this ballot access issue, we're beginning to realize that the opposite is true. That
mm-hmm.
if we all come together for the things that we all believe, that we have a much greater opportunity to be able to enact all of these reforms.
Mm-hmm. So instead of dividing, you multiply.
Exactly. And part of the whole working with political power is that people who have it a lot of times use the divide and conquer.
Well, they've certainly done that to us, haven't they?
Oh, absolutely. They try to tell you, you know, you groups out there, you're opposed to each other. You should be fighting with each other. You know, they tell people all kinds of canards, like, you know, you can't fight City Hall, or what can one person do? You know, one person can't really accomplish anything by themselves, and you're all alone out there. And you know, one vote doesn't make a difference. But as we've gotten together and we've started to talk to each other, we've realized that people from all across this political spectrum, you know, our group includes, you know, Libertarian Party, Green Party, the Constitution Party. We're open to any other political party that's organized here in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm. What have you found out
about the people? And nonprofits all across the spectrum. We realize that we have a lot more in common with each other than we do with the people who are in power trying to keep us off the ballot.
True. What if you've gotten to know some people you didn't know and probably never would have thought you'd have gotten to know politically?
Mm-hmm.
What have you found out about them that, you know, that sort of informs you and has changed your life?
Well, that we're all pretty much motivated by the same thing, that we want people to be free, to be able to make the decisions for their own lives, as they see fit, instead of having some self-appointed master out there trying to direct our lives for us and to have us live for some goals that we may or may not choose to buy into ourselves.
Mm-hmm. And some of the groups that you're working with are sort of overtly leftists, and people who come from the other side look at those people and they generally think, that's somebody who wants to control my life. Are you finding that that's not necessarily true? That those people really can want you to control your own life?
I can tell you a little story about that, which fascinates me. I've been following the North Carolina Green Party for some time. And I noticed early on that we did share one very key philosophical outlook, which is decentralism. That the more power you can invest in smaller units of government all the way down to the individual, the better things will work. And I've been following the changes in their platform for some time, and a lot of times, particularly leftists, when they get involved in politics, they have this idealistic sense that government can provide these solutions for them. But when I was at this State Green Convention last month, a whole lot of people came up to me, and we had a lot of great one-on-one conversations, and they all, every single one of them, said, you know, I'm with you libertarians on this, you know, whatever this was, and for every person it was a different issue, but the common thread was that they had put a lot of time and effort into that particular issue, and they had really come to a deep, real-world understanding of how this issue works and how we can find solutions on whatever their pet issue was for the benefit of people.
Mm-hmm. So
and they realized the government really wasn't the source that was going to give them a solution, and quite often was an obstacle to keeping people from finding the solution.
So what you're saying is that people from the left are finding that the solution is something they didn't expect it to be. It sort of refutes the whole direction of their own philosophy, and they're looking at the philosophy of decentralism, libertarianism, as a solution that they're discovering now for themselves.
You know, and this is why we feel these election reform issues in particular are very important, because the whole one thing that we've found, again, talking to people with all these different issues that they've brought forward, is that, again, the motivation is exactly the same. We want to see a system of government and politics in this country where every single person, every citizen, has the opportunity to participate equally along with every other citizen. And we feel that if we can open up the process, get rid of the impediments that keep people from being full participants in our system of politics and our system of elections, you know, that they're going to be able to go out and get that real-world experience, that they're going to be encouraged to become engaged and not just sit back and derive their views from what they see on TV news, you know, but to actually get out in their communities and you know, use politics to try to actually find real-world solutions for people. And as people get more actually involved in the real action of the system, you know, all kinds of great things happen. A lot of different people come together, and you get those synergies of different kinds of creative ideas from all different, like I said, all different viewpoints and all different walks of life.
So would you say what's going on here is that on top of working on ballot access, what you're doing is actually sort of creating a platform that includes some common values and common goals that can extend in other directions?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I really think it does have, you know, because religion and politics are two sort of inescapable aspects of human life. You know, you're dealing politics. There's an element of politics in just about every kind of relationship that you have with people, particularly when you're talking about the community level, whether it's your neighborhood or the nation or anything in between. So the more people, the more investment that and access people feel that they have in their communities, the more that we're going to be able to come up with a politics that is actually based on common good, on healing, and on human advancement, instead of the politics that we have now, which is pretty much, you know, well, let me get my little piece right here, and then and then shut the door behind me and keep anybody else from getting what I've been able to achieve.
You know, it's really interesting you'd say that, because, of course, most people have a conception of what it is to be a libertarian, and they look at the Libertarian Party as being this sort of group that is made up of very asocial guys who only want to have their pot and their porn and their money, so they don't have to pay taxes and don't have to help anybody, and that most of them actually live in their mom's basements and they're still sleeping on their Star Wars sheets. Now, that's a stereotype, and of course you and I both know that it's not true, but do you get much of that when you make contact with people who, you know, they're Greens, they're liberals, that might have been their preconception about you?
Oh, certainly. And, I mean, there's some truth generally behind stereotypes, too. The first thing I was thinking when you were talking about that was that the Libertarian Party and other libertarian organizations inside and outside of electoral politics have exactly that effect that I was just talking about. And it takes people who feel like they've been alone, who want to get engaged in political life for one reason or another, and as they get out and start meeting people, you know, their views change and their approach to politics changes. I think part of the history of the Libertarian Party is that we've grown up to be a social organization, even though we've kept our very individualistic streak. And the whole point of what libertarian politics is about is so people can live their lives as they see fit. Just because, you know, just as I want to be able to live my life as I see fit, and you start to realize how giving that to other people, giving that liberty to other people, and creating more liberty for other people creates more liberty for yourself. But it's very interesting. You asked about how the Green relationship has grown, and about 3 years ago, when we started talking about these coalition efforts, there was tremendous resistance on both sides and tremendous prejudice about, you know, from libertarians about what a Green was or from Greens about what a libertarian was. I had even been publicly attacked
by some leftists
for getting involved in leftist coalition efforts. You know, stay away from those libertarians because they're just about, you know, greed and whatever else. But
so
as you get to know people...
You were attacked by libertarians or you were attacked by the left?
I'm sorry?
You were attacked by libertarians or attacked by the left?
Well, by people on the left. I wouldn't say I was so much attacked by people within the Libertarian Party as just dismissed at first. But one big problem that we have with politics in America today is that we deal with it so much on the theoretical level, and we're willing to label people with an idea or something, some description. And then when we actually get out into the real world and meet these people, we find out that people are much more complex than we've given them credit for, and that any label can convey, and that even if they're advocating solutions that are completely the opposite of what we're advocating, they still have the same motivations. I meet with a lot of Democrats and Republicans, and when I first got involved in politics, I had this prejudice that they were a bunch of horned devils that were just out for their own little power base.
Tell our audience how long you've been in politics, what your first political meeting was.
Well, my first political meeting was when I was 3 years old at a Barry Goldwater rally in Tulsa, Oklahoma. My grandfather was a politician in Arizona, rose to the level of Speaker of the House for a couple terms out there, so it's in my family. I was always raised as a political person, and I've always been active at one level or another. I've been active in the Libertarian Party here in North Carolina very much since 1994,
uh-huh. I'd
say for about 12 years now.
Well, you were there, and Barry waved to you. I hope he waved back.
Oh, yes. It was the first time I ever got into the newspaper. The Tulsa Daily World, big picture on the local section. Barry came in, campaigning for president, flew in, got in his plane, gave a speech, and went off to his next campaign stop. And they had a big picture of me there in the paper. They didn't have a picture of Goldwater, but they had a picture of me on my dad's shoulders waiting for Goldwater to arrive. And then they quoted me in the paper as saying, "Hi, Barry."
Hi, Barry, yes.
Yep.
Did you get your own Barry Goldwater button?
I did not get a button, I don't think. I have a few bits of memorabilia stashed away upstairs. I have that article clipped and saved. I have a bit of an ego in that I keep just about every single piece of media that I've ever appeared in. So I was real glad to hear that this show is being archived on the internet. I'll be happy to, you know, play it for my sweetie later.
Well, that'll be nice.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. I can't promise it's going to be immediately, but they try to get it up there as soon as possible because they're really great guys. But let's go on a little bit. They've heard a little bit about your background now, and so they can see you haven't been like a libertarian all of your life. This is something that you came to in the 90s. Why did you become a libertarian? You'd been a Republican, right?
Well, I was raised Republican. My upbringing was as a Goldwater liberal. Besides Goldwater, the other big political icon in my house was Dr. Martin Luther King. And, in fact, I think the only time I ever saw my dad cry was the night that Dr. King was assassinated. And so it was sort of an interesting upbringing, and I think made me a natural libertarian. I feel like I've always been a natural libertarian. And I knew about the Libertarian Party and was active in it as early as 1979. But I didn't get involved with it until 1994 because, to me, a political party is a very specific kind of organization.
Mm-hmm.
It's meant to engage in the electoral sphere, to run candidates for office, and to try to change public policy, and not to sit around. And it's not an educational organization. It's not a social organization or a debate club of any kind. although those kinds of aspects do take place within any political party. But it wasn't until 1992, really, that I started to see that seriousness, that understanding coming from libertarians. In fact, I remember it very clearly. I was lying on my couch one Sunday afternoon, flipping channels, and I came across PBS gives 5 minutes to every congressional candidate in the state every election, and they rerun it several times. And I came across it, and they had a libertarian running in every race. And darn it, if half of them didn't show up in a suit and tie, and they were talking about issues people really cared about, like education and the environment, I didn't hear anybody talking about stuff like your constitutional right to own a battleship or other kinds of, you know, how many enumerated powers can dance on the head of the 10th Amendment, you know, the kinds of conversations I was used to from libertarians. I kind of felt like, well, if you want to talk about that stuff, I can do that, you know, over a beer at the bar. You know, we don't need a political party to talk about these finer philosophical points. To actually see libertarians, I said, put on that suit and tie and go out and engage people in this state on their level and not on some hyper-intellectual level, that's what told me that the Libertarian Party was really ready to be a political party and really ready to try to change public policy for people here in North Carolina. And I jumped in with both feet. Once I actually got in, I got active very quickly and have been extremely active ever since and been enjoying it.
So what would you say about the Libertarian Party of North Carolina? Is it an effective political tool?
I think so. I think it has been. I think it comes and goes. You know, a lot of these senses of understanding come in cycles. But overall, I think as libertarians get that sense of engagement in the real world political process and in real public policy, we learn how to take our very individualist philosophy and apply it in a way that is of benefit, real benefit to people, not just theoretical benefit to people, but we actually get out and meet people and we see for our own eyes and hear with our own ears, you know, what people really want out of their lives and what they think is going to be able to give them the liberty to achieve their own dreams. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I had to ask this. Here you are, you're going out and you're meeting people as a libertarian and representative of that party.
Mm-hmm.
And you must have been also engaging in debates with people from other political parties and from also, and this is the most interesting, the party in which you had formerly been active, the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm.
What was
Well, they're
like?
Generally afraid to debate me.
They're afraid to debate
me. Republicans are. But I have plenty of experience being on the road with Greens, and I love that. I really tried to arrange a lot of events where and one person in particular, the chair of the Green Party here, who's been the chair for a while, a lady named Alina Everett, we just make a great team because one thing that we found with the Greens that we have in common and that anybody who's not a Democrat or a Republican really has in common with each other is that since we don't have a lot of that big special interest money behind us and we don't have that motivation, our only motivation, the motivation for anybody to get involved in a third party or a movement like that, is because they really believe that whatever ideas and whatever philosophy they're putting out is going to be of benefit to the people.
Mm-hmm.
And I always make that point when we have these events or when I debate Elena. We'll disagree on a lot of issues, and we'll take it to each other on a lot of issues. You know, but it's always motivated by what we think is really best, and that creates an honesty and it creates a mutual respect.
Mm-hmm.
And I always like to point out that this is what bipartisanship could be. That this is the face of true bipartisanship.
But this is where America should be.
That's exactly right. We should have a political system where absolutely everybody should be able to, you know, come together and be able to say, well, this is what I believe and this is what I think will work. You know, and to have that conversation, to have that freedom to try new ideas and to...
And to test new ideas.
Absolutely. And this is one of the reasons why we feel like third parties in particular are very important. Because and Democrats and Republicans who get it always cite this one, because this is, from their perspective, the real benefit, is that we bring up issues that establishment politicians are afraid to discuss. They don't really understand the issues. Of course, the first time that you bring up any kind of issue at all, a lot of people are scared of change. A lot of people are put off by it until they learn more about it and they get comfortable with it. And there's certainly a lot of libertarian issues that I've seen over time, just in my 12 years of activism, move from the nutty fringes to the mainstream. I mean, the war on drugs is a great example.
Mm-hmm.
We've been talking about ending the war on drugs from the beginning.
1971.
That's right. And I remember very specifically right around the end of 1999, because I have a lot of experience being on the radio, and I love to take callers, and whenever I was on the radio up until that point, we'd always get the drug question early on, and people would say, oh, you want to give crack to school children? And, you know, people were kind of freaking out over.
Yes, but you want to put it in vending machines, right?
Right, exactly. But we just stayed persistent, kept putting out the same message, kept gathering together the same kinds of facts and that indicate what our position really means and what the effects of both the war on drugs and what the kind of freedom that we advocate would actually have on people. And it was really, like I said, about 6 years ago that started to change, to the point where I could get through a radio show without the drug question coming up. Or when it did, a lot of the callers were very supportive
mm-hmm.
of our view that through, it's like advertising. And it's this exact same thing. You have to keep repeating and repeating and repeating a message. And eventually it's going to feel normal to most people.
Well, also, what's happened with the drug war is intruding on more and more people's lives every day.
Well, exactly.
And they see it, they understand, they see it happening and impacting their own families when they always thought it was going to be something about somebody else.
Yeah,
and now they can see what the impact is, and they don't like it.
That's the sort of sad... the really sad upside of the Libertarian Party, in a way. In that,
yeah, we told them so.
Well, in that we get a lot more people who have their own horror story to tell, whether it's about drugs or whether it's about something else. And it relates back to what I was talking about with the Greens and their growing sympathy for libertarian ideas, because they've got some kind of horror story, like this happened to somebody I know, or this happened to me, or this happened to somebody in my family, that they've had a real-world encounter
mm-hmm.
with the brute force of government. And it's really opened their eyes, and I hate to see, but it just seems like that's a natural aspect of radical politics, is that in order for you to get your point across, a lot of terrible things have to happen to prove that, well, yeah, we told you so.
Well, actually, Christ always spoke in parables.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was the way people best understood it. And what's happening is that reality is creating the parables for us.
Absolutely. We have now plenty of real-world examples. And that's another real advantage to getting out and actually working with people. And now the Internet makes it very easy. You can be both at the same time. You can sit there in front of your computer all day, but you can actually get out into other communities and learn more about people and put information out there or gather information that is going to be of real-world use.
Mm-hmm. And there's so many, you're right, with the drug wars, there's so many examples out there. Case in point, I don't know if you were aware of the case that took place. It must have been about 12 years ago now, and it was actually in Malibu in California. And there was a man, he owned a big chunk of land. He had a very successful corporation. He sold it. He was kind of a loner, bought a nice place up in the mountains, and simply lived there. And they decided he must be smoking and must be growing pot. So they surveyed the land, They took pictures. They didn't actually see any pot, but they knew there must be pot.
Of course.
And what they did was they just divvied up the land because, of course, they fully intended to use asset forfeiture and take the land immediately as soon as they arrested him.
Mm-hmm.
So they had decided how who was going to get the land, how the land was going to be used. And they had actually divvied it up between several different agencies. And then they broke into his house late at night without announcing who they were, and they shot him to death. Now, he had a gun. They didn't announce who they were.
Mm-hmm.
He pulled the gun. They shot him. And he was dead. They never found any pot.
No. Well, I imagine.
Not one tiny fraction of a gram, and nothing growing there.
Yeah. Well, there was also a case not that long ago, I think in Missouri, of a sheriff's department that targeted people for drug charges based on the cars that they drove. And it was because they wanted the car. You know, it was a legal way for them to target a victim and steal their car. And it's just the more draconian laws that we try to put on the people, the more it's an invitation to corruption.
Yeah,
for
which
law
of course
enforcement.
Is an invitation to sin.
Exactly.
Which is one of the things, of course, that we've been warned about to use, and that we are using tools, and we're allowing tools to be used that invite other people to compromise their immortal souls. That's pretty frightening, isn't it?
Well, it is, and it. Now, one of the points I've always tried to make about drugs in particular, and I don't know if people listen to Neil Bortz, Neil Bortz has been hammering on this point for the last few days now about the draconian laws against sex offenders in Georgia, to the point where you can't even live within 1,000 feet of a proposed school bus stop, which means that anybody who's ever gotten that red letter put on their forehead that they're a sex offender, you know, whether it's for actually being a real sex offender or just, you know, a 16-year-old sleeping with their 14-year-old girlfriend and everything in between, you know, that there was no place in Georgia anymore where people could live. And when you make things that hard on sinners, you know, for committing some kind of what we politically judge to be sin, then you just drive it underground. And we've certainly seen this with the war on drugs, where because they're illegal, we try to make sure, if people are interested in getting them, they try to make sure it happens beyond the view of anybody else. It's not out in the open at all. And if it were out in the open, then people who had drug problems, you know, could come forward and get treatment. Right now, if you have a drug problem and you know you need to get treatment, you don't want to come forward for fear of being thrown in jail.
Well,
that's
course,
not the treatment you're seeking.
That's one of the reasons that, for all of those reasons, of course, having any kind of drug laws is crazy.
Mm-hmm.
It also, of course, you know, tends to capitalize the worst part of society, the people who are willing to deal in drugs.
Well, yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, we just handed that over, just as we saw with Prohibition. You know, we handed that over to organized crime.
And that's exactly
and,
where the Kennedy
came from. And with organized crime, we get the drive-by shootings, and we get, you know, a lot of the other violence that is associated with that. And you don't have drive-by shootings over packs of cigarettes, at least not yet. You know, they're trying to jack up those taxes and ratchet up things against cigarette smokers. And as we've seen in states up in the northeastern part of the country, and in Canada, where they have jacked up these cigarette taxes, that's been an open invitation to organized crime to take over that business.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the reasons why I brought up the sex offender issue in Georgia is because Neil pointed out very well that one of the unintended consequences of this is for people who are sex offenders to get off the registry, to hide from the government, you know, to get out from this system. And so the whole system that's supposed to secure law and order completely breaks down.
Yes, but now let's look at this for a moment. What do you do with somebody who's a sex offender? The whole point that the Dolores and Megan's law came into existence was because people weren't informed when sex offenders lived right next door.
Well, now.
And we're also calling for transparency.
Well, that's the thing. And transparency is a very good word to bring up, because so little of this is transparent on a couple of different levels. And it sort of brings things back to electoral reform, because one of the issues, one of the ways that people can be invested and feel like they're a part of the system is if it is transparent to them. And if laws are created outside of the view and the participation of the people, then it's much more likely to be bad law, and it's much more likely to be against the people. But also with our language, we make things obscure instead of making things transparent. And certainly the sex offender issue is a great issue, because you just say those two words, and well, of course, everybody's alarmed about sex offenders. You know, I don't want a sex offender living in my community or in my neighborhood or having access to my children. But let's examine that issue for a moment, because I mentioned before that in practice, they take everybody who's committed any kind of offense vaguely related to sexuality. You know, and you just can't treat child rapists the same way as you treat, you know, a 16-year-old that's sleeping with a 14-year-old girlfriend or somebody who urinates in public, you know, on the side of a building. You know, there's a very wide variety of offenses there. And
well,
if you paint them all with the same brush and put this label on
them. But isn't this something the government does? Because it's using a particular way of looking at people. It lumps things together. It doesn't look at us as individuals. And one of the extrapolations of that, using that tool, is lumping things together to make it easy for them. And remember, our whole prison system has become a profit center for government, generating billions and billions and billions of dollars every year in many different ways.
Absolutely. They have a financial incentive to keep putting more and more people in prison.
And this gives them another reason for doing it and creating more bureaucracy to justify it. And, of course, it's such a highly emotionally charged issue that you don't even see people really objecting that much. Because, of course, we all want our children to be safe. But this doesn't really make them safer. If it was more transparent and more pointed, it would be safer.
Because
there are people out there we don't want near our children under any circumstances.
And that's why I keep coming back to this concept of real-world engagement versus intellectualism. Not that I'm against intellectualism, but it needs to be coupled with that real-world experience in order to be effective. And if we just think about these things as concepts or as philosophical ideas, we can come to a lot of wrong conclusions about people, and we can create a lot of separateness, a lot of alienation between people. Whereas and we're starting to find that out even on this extremely emotionally charged issue, that these laws have gotten to be so extreme that they're starting to have the opposite of the intended effect. And people who get involved in these kinds of issues, they're interested in what's really going to work. You know, it's one thing to say, well, we can pass a law. You know, there's no law that's going to make anybody safer.
Well, that's
at all.
That's one of the problems with laws, which,
you know,
and it's really questionable whether or not any of the laws in a lot of these different arenas should ever have been passed at all. And they probably wouldn't have been if government hadn't taken on to itself in 1789 the right to legislate and create privileges instead of allowing people to exercise their inherent God-given rights.
Exactly. I think that's an excellent point. It's been an aspect of law even before then. But the history of liberty, and I truly believe that the course of human history is a march towards liberty, that there are pendulum swings back and forth, and it may seem dark at any particular moment. And it seems to be getting pretty dark right now.
Oh, well,
here in America.
Yes. Right on the verge of fascism, we're definitely in the dark.
It is. If you look at it, it's sort of that micro level of decades. You know, but if you take a step back and look at the centuries or even the millennia, and to me, human civilization is more or less defined as getting away from the idea that might makes right. And the more we can get away from might makes right, and the more we can develop our idea of human liberty and what that really means to be free, People realize that that's what they want. They realize that liberty is the tool that is going to allow them to realize their dreams, to live their lives as they see fit, and it's going to give them the security to be able to continue to grow along that path.
Let's enlarge on this theme a little bit, because you've used the phrase that people hear over and over again, might makes right. Well, of course, we know that that's not true, but that's actually a shorthand term of talking about something that's very representational of government and the way it's been used for the last 2,000 years, which is a hierarchy, a rigid structure where the people on the top tell the people on the bottom exactly what they're supposed to do and what they're supposed to be. And that conception of human relationships, if you will, is actually 180 degrees away from, you know, something that was became extremely significant 2,000 years ago and remains so today, which is Christianity. Because Christ said that we were all one in him. There isn't anything about Christianity that directs you to a hierarchy. It's actually directing you to a very different form of human organization that I'm not even going to call government. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Absolutely, I'd agree with that. And I read, you know, as I keep reading my Bible and keep trying to understand the Word of God that I feel like is revealed in there, that really is the message that I keep taking away from it. One of the first things I did after I had my born-again experience back
Tell
in
us about that. That's fascinating.
Well, I often say I feel a little uncomfortable talking about it because it's so personal. And I'm not really trying to proselytize to people. I'm trying to witness. And there's a difference there.
And we all appreciate that.
Yeah, but I had an experience in 1997 where I guess the statute of limitations has run out. I could talk about it fairly openly. I was trying to help out a friend of mine who had escaped from parole and was trying to establish a new identity. And I was trying to help him out with that here in North Carolina. And it was a very confusing time for me because I feel like I read people very well, and that every judgment that I had made about people at that point turned out to be wrong. I thought that the people who would naturally want to help turned out to be violently opposed to helping us out, and a lot of people that I did not expect at all to be sympathetic, you know, rose up and were real helpful during that time. And I was struggling with these issues, driving down I-85 to go visit one of these friends who had been particularly helpful, who's now in prison himself, actually, for something else, you know, and I'm trying to work with him on that now. But in any case, I was just at the end of my rope. I didn't know where else to turn, and so I started praying to Jesus. And I said, you know, well, Jesus, if you're there, I could really use your help right now. And as I was driving down the road, and this is one of the things I love about my religion, is that God has a great sense of humor, and he always sends messengers that you would never expect.
Amen.
Oh, yeah. I was driving down the road, and I saw this fella, this poor schmuck. He had his car broken down, and about 50 yards later, I saw him walking towards the next exit. And I never stop for people. If I do anything like that on the highway, I'll stop at the next exit and call the highway patrol and tell them a motorist needs assistance. But there was a voice in my head that was not my voice that said, no, you need to stop and help this person. So I went up to the next exit, turned around, went back two exits, went back up the same highway, and by the time 10 minutes or so it took me to do that, this fellow had only made it maybe another 50 yards. Picked him up, took him to the next truck stop. This is a Vietnam veteran named Ed, who had this crazy idea that he could buy this old Junker Buick on the coast and drive it all the way to his home in the mountains on one tank of gas. And he'd run out of gas somewhere around Burlington. But as soon as he told me what his name was and what his situation was, he repeated my prayer to me, back to me, word for word. And that was a really stunning thing to me. You know, and it was a fairly complex prayer. You know, it wasn't just a sentence or two. And he was just, he had this blissful air about him. Just like, oh, I wasn't worried. I knew somebody would come by and help me out. And I gave him $20 for gas, and I offered to drive him back to his car with the gas. He said, oh, no, you know, some trucker will come along and take me back there, no problem. And when I was done seeing my friend that evening and I drove back, I stopped at that spot, and there was absolutely no evidence whatsoever that there had been a car there or it had been broken down at that spot. So it's just interesting to me, the messengers that God sends to us to give us these messages. And now I'm trying to remember exactly why I was talking about the born-again experience.
Because I asked you to.
I know you did, but it was jumping off point from something else.
Yeah, it was. But let's go back for a moment to coalitions.
Yeah.
Because I think that that's a natural mix, actually. Because in many ways it sounds to me like what you're doing is you're taking almost a missionary position with libertarians to show them that it isn't really scary, that this is a wonderful approach, that this actually brings us closer to people that we really need to be closer to, one for ourselves and two for them.
Yeah. Well, just as with religion, you need to witness. If you want to persuade people that your ideas are correct, it's nice to be able to debate them in a philosophical context, but you're never really going to convince anybody
or
much anything in that. But if they see how you live your principles in your life, and they see the positive results of either what you've been able to generate in your own life or what you've generated for other people, or just that you generate because people are around you. You know, and they, if they can actually see that in you, if you actually get to know people instead of the ideas that you've labeled the people with,
mm-hmm.
then you really come to understand a lot about what they're talking about, and you end up being a whole lot more open to then listening to their ideas and then having that philosophical debate.
Mm-hmm.
I always try to tell our candidates that the impression that people have, the voters will have, of libertarianism is, in 98% of the people, is going to be based on the first libertarian that they met, the first person that they knew on a personal level, who they knew was a libertarian. And so if they like that person, then they're going to think libertarianism is okay.
So
but if they thought that person was a jerk, then they're going to think all libertarians are jerks.
So you're saying witness for freedom.
Absolutely. I mean, you have to go out and live your freedom. And freedom is one of those things where if you're active in trying to secure it for other people, more of it is going to come to you. I mean, all the good things in life are like that. Love, you know, and everything else. You know, the more of that you give away, the more of it's going to come back to you.
Hey, well, amen. So do you think that that is sort of one of the things that has affected the people that you've known from other political parties so that now you've created trust between you?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the key element, we were talking a little bit before about 3 years ago versus today and that how that mistrust has evaporated. And I believe that from the green or the leftist side, that one of the main reasons why that trust has evaporated is because they have seen us in action working for the things that they believe in, particularly ballot access for them.
Mm-hmm.
They recognize that, you know, we're an older party here, we've been at it longer, we've been more successful at it, and at every step of the way, we've been fighting not only for our own rights to be on the ballot and run candidates and engage in the political process, but for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
We've always been working for these reforms that are going to keep the door open for not just the Libertarian Party, but every other party after us that wants to come on in and be part of the process. And it's so you can talk a good game, and that's very nice, but they've actually seen us in action working for something that's of direct benefit to them. And then the more people see that and recognize it, the more respect you're going to get, and the more likely people are going to want to listen to what you have to say and want to come work with you.
Mm-hmm. So what you do is you've created trust. You've created a future capital in trust and a possibility of further good things happening.
Oh, exactly. This sort of harkens back to what you're talking about right at the beginning of the show, and what I was thinking while you were talking about that, as you were talking about building up that political capital, I can just think about in my own 12 years of doing this, that's a long enough amount of time that some of that has come back to me in one way or another, that I've crossed paths again with somebody that I worked with in the past, and that that relationship has been, I mean, a really good example is that we have a ballot access reform bill as a hearing in front of a Senate committee next Wednesday, the day after Independence Day,
mm-hmm.
and the chair of that committee is extremely solicitous to me. He really wants to know exactly what do we want done, and that's what I'm going to go ahead and do with this committee. And that's because we had had a relationship before where we'd worked together on a different issue before, and that positive political capital carried forward and is paying off now. Jesse, I thought, said it pretty well. It said the opposite of it, which is be careful not to step on the toes today that's connected to the ass you have to kiss tomorrow.
How true. Well, and I think that's a good place to stop. And I want to thank you so much. This has been a fantastic interview. And I want to, you know, just blessings on the work that you're doing for Coalition in North Carolina and connecting people. Connecting people not only to libertarianism and freedom, but to solutions for all of our lives.
Well, thanks so much. It's been a great pleasure being on the show. I mean, you're absolutely right. We get so head up about labels, and what really counts is real freedom. And in a way, I really don't care what we call it. As long as people can get some liberty, it's going to be good for everybody.
Amen. You take care. Good night.
All right. Have fun. Thanks.
Thanks. Bye. And that's our show for today, Friday, June 30th, 2006. Tonight we have thought about coalitions. We tend to use the word politically, but really, as you can see, it means more than that. Coming together to create change, to know each other, to be open to resolving disagreements, is to open ourselves to the possibility of trust and cooperation and love. Each of these things also opens us to knowing ourselves in new ways that enrich our own lives, taking that life in directions we probably didn't even imagine were possible. When we experience this kind of growth, our perspective on the world changes with us, and what we thought of as the truth, immutable, unchangeable, and constant, also shifts. To understand the course of life, we need to study the entire curriculum. And knowing that, an often unexpected confrontation with the truth helps each of us continue our own spiritual evolutionary process and become a better, stronger, and more spiritually aware and alive individual. Life is complex, and in this way we're working to understand that government is a tool, at times complex, at times simple, but just a tool intended for us to use to do what we cannot do for ourselves. Remember to ask yourself today, is government the tool he meant us to use to better love one another? Think about that the next time you drive by someone who needs help on the street. On this show, as we do with all our shows, we end by reading the section of the Declaration of Independence that is America's mission statement. This remains where we want to go today. It's up to each of us to ensure we reach that destination. Prudence, indeed, will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for life and transient causes. And accordingly, all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evidences a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. When we know, when we have the truth, we are armed to take action. Know the truth, and the truth will set you free. This is Melinda Pillsbury Foster coming to you from BBS Radio. God bless the journey that will bring us to freedom. And may God be with you every step of the way. Good night.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning in to our radio program. And we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.